Maybe it's just me, but this felt like an especially global economy kind of day today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 25th day of September. Good as always to have you here, everybody. The global economy in a minute. But first, 1 billion is the neatly symmetrical number with which we begin today. $1 billion is what Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg paid to buy Instagram back in 2012. And 1 billion people is how many users the photo sharing app has right now. The company is, however, about to have two fewer employees. The co-founders of Instagram, also its two top executives, announced last night they're leaving. Kevin Systrom and Mike Krieger are their names. So as we do when we have questions about what the heck is going on in Silicon Valley, we have called Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So look, we got to say first that founders leave after acquisitions all the time, but this somehow feels different. Is it?
It does feel different, partly because it's been a while since Instagram was acquired. We know that, you know, there have been signs that there was perhaps some tension brewing. The direction of Instagram has really changed. And let's be honest, the pressure and focus on Instagram has really changed as it has evolved into kind of the primary growth engine at Facebook. I think that probably there's a lot more attention on it. It is the brand that's kind of untainted by scandal. Apparently, a majority of Americans don't even know that Instagram is owned by Facebook. And the founders, upon leaving in their blog post, said that they were leaving to, quote, explore our curiosity and creativity again.
Or spend more time with their families, you know.
Kind of a bummer, right? Yeah. So, but you could imagine that it's become a bit of a machine.
Yeah. So talk to me actually about that machine, right? Are we seeing, and well, let me actually ask it first person. I am seeing in my Instagram feed, since I have disconnected from Facebook, I'm seeing a whole bunch more Facebookization of Instagram.
I am also seeing that, and a lot of users are seeing that, and they're just not happy about it. There's a lot more clutter. And if, in fact, if anyone listening knows how to make that constant IGTV notification go away, I would appreciate your tips. There is just a lot more happening. The ads have become a lot more frequent, the sponsored posting. You know, it was a while back now, but Instagram got rid of the chronological feed, and now your stuff is delivered to you via algorithm. So they are certainly introducing a lot more, the stories, you know, the messaging, a lot more sort of social networking features into it, and people really appreciate it. The simplicity back in the day.
Do you believe, though, that this winds up hurting Facebook, the corporate overlord, as it were, or no?
I mean, certainly the stock market has not responded positively. I think just because it is the shining jewel right now in the Facebook empire. I think it's also worth noting here, let's not forget that just back in January, the founder of WhatsApp also left because of concerns and tension about data and privacy. There aren't usually signs of dissent at Facebook. And so to have, you know, two, I guess, three people do big exits like this in a row does seem like kind of a big deal. And it's going to be a real test of Mark Zuckerberg's leadership. He's pretty much now, you know, he and Sheryl Sandberg are where the buck stops in terms of keeping these products going and keeping them growing.
Right. And we've had conversations before about how Zuckerberg doesn't always necessarily see what the future will bring, you know?
Right. And he's very certain of his path. And clearly, these product leaders may be disagreeing with that a little bit. And so we, you know, ultimately, the only thing that matters is what users and advertisers do. And advertisers will follow the users.
Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech. Thanks, Molly.
Thanks, Kai.
Two more quick things on that story. First of all, we had Kevin Systrom on the program about 3, maybe 4 years ago. I think you can hear that interview at marketplace.org. Also, and here comes the shameless self-promotion part of this afternoon's broadcast. If you want to follow us on Instagram, you can. We're at Marketplace APM. All right, moving on. Crude oil is in the middle of a bit of a rally. Brent crude, the global benchmark, hit 4-year highs today. Higher demand, looming sanctions that are going to take Iranian oil off the market. Also, OPEC's decision this past weekend to not bump up its production, if you're looking for causation. But I'll tell you what, those higher prices are really good news for American producers who are facing more challenges than just getting the stuff out of the ground. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains that one.
One of American oil's big challenges isn't environmental, it isn't geological, it's financial.
I think the biggest factor in the continued growth of American oil is the availability of capital.
Bethany McLean is author of the book Saudi America, Fracking is very expensive, so many shale oil extractors have a lot of debt. Their return on assets, according to one report, is just 0.1%.
Right now, the industry doesn't produce cash flow on its own, and so it's dependent on investors being willing to continue to invest and literally put billions of dollars into the ground.
Investors were happy to do that when interest rates were low, but what about now that they're rising?
Should that capital go away, American oil production is going to slow.
But for every reason to doubt U.S. oil, you can find a reason to be optimistic.
Costs have come down really dramatically over the past, 5 years or so.
Jason Fear is with Poten & Partners, an oil advisory and brokerage company. Technological advancement in fracking has been rapid.
There's been an enormous increase in productivity and efficiency.
Shale oil, it's worth bearing in mind, is a very young industry. Frank Verastro is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
On conventional wells, we've got, 100 years of experience. On unconventional wells, we literally have less than 5 years.
Add to that uncertainties about energy conservation, foreign oil supply, capital. And the future of the American oil industry is about as clear as oil itself. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Which is not very clear. President Trump talked about OPEC and oil in his speech at the United Nations today. Also, he brought up this.
The United States has just announced tariffs on another $200 billion in Chinese-made goods for a total so far of $250 billion. I have great respect and affection for my friend, President Xi, but I have made clear our trade imbalance is just not acceptable.
Two things about that. Number one, trade imbalances aren't in and of themselves bad. Number two, and also, one does wonder how trade negotiations are going between Washington and Beijing. On Wall Street today, with apologies to Samuel Beckett, traders were waiting for the Fed. Big meeting on interest rates wraps up tomorrow. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Running a small business in this economy is tough to begin with. Now you throw in what could fairly be characterized as a dynamic trade policy environment, and the difficulty goes to 11. So how, if you are running the aforementioned small business, do you deal with the changing and moving goalposts and what that means to your suppliers, your customers, and your bottom line? Marketplace's Scott Tong caught up with a guy running his family-owned business here in California.
Jeff Starin is the president of Rostar Filters north of L.A. It sells all kinds of filters for your car. Some they make, some they import from China. He calls his company methodical in its planning. But his business model suddenly blew up when the latest tariffs were announced.
We have containers that departed port in China when there was no tariff. And by the time they're arriving here in Los Angeles, there will be a tariff.
This is the Trump administration's third round of tariffs on Chinese stuff. In July, all the cabin air filters Rostar imports faced tariffs. Now it's all Chinese filters.
We have to pay those tariffs up front no matter what. For example, a container of cabin filters, once this first round of tariffs went in, that duty was $12,000 or $13,000 per shipping container.
Often he has dozens of containers on the ocean at a time. So he pays hundreds of thousands of dollars in tariffs up front, and he doesn't make that money back for months.
That puts an enormous financial strain on the finances of a small family-owned business.
The argument for tariffs is they return jobs to the U.S. Indeed, Jeff Starin's customers are pleading for more U.S.-made filters from his California workshop so they can avoid higher costs. Rostar's machines fold filters, they glue them, they cut them.
They come down the conveyor belt, we mark them made in USA.
Thing is, there's no magic button to boost production from, say, 1,000 filters per hour up to 5,000. He could invest in another assembly line.
It would take us a year to get it, realistically. Well, we don't know what the landscape is going to look like in a year.
Will the tariffs be gone by then? Will all these extra orders dry up? Who knows?
Tell me the good news or tell me the bad news, but let me know what it is so I can react. Businesses cannot operate in an environment of not knowing what's coming with such major things.
Which leaves him with what he calls bad choices. He could turn away customers, or he could import from another country, which means starting all over and finding brand new suppliers.
This is a story we're hearing over and over again.
International trade attorney Lynn Fisher Fox at Arnold & Porter advises U.S. companies.
They have relationships with Chinese manufacturers, and it's probably a long process of making sure they know how to make the products properly.
So she says many companies will still buy from China and pass along the tariff costs to their customers. That's what Jeff Starin does.
Our industry is largely made up of small family-owned businesses. We don't have the resources to absorb these costs.
He says a lot of auto services are going to get pricier.
Think about the owner of a vehicle who their brake job just went up by $120. Well, they're probably going to put that off.
Fewer customers and fewer sales will hurt the economy, says attorney Lynn Fisher Fox.
You know, changing the price from $10 to $12 will make somebody not buy it, and enough somebodies don't buy it. There are going to be impacts.
As in potentially fewer jobs in companies like Jeff Starin's.
I love the idea of bringing jobs back to the U.S. From what I see, this is going to cost far more jobs than it creates.
This week's new tariffs, by the way, go up from 10% to 25% in January. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There's been a sharp drop in how much foreign companies are spending to buy, start, or build businesses here in the United States. Foreign direct investment is the technical term, and it's down 69% compared to the first half of last year. That decline trickles down to states and counties that compete for the jobs and the dollars that that investment brings. And yes, it is preliminary data, but an early and tangible sign of trade policy made real, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
I first met Clint O'Neill last June at an international trade conference sponsored by the Commerce Department. O'Neill is Executive Vice President of the Arkansas Economic Development Commission. He was handing out business cards and pens, hoping to catch the eye of foreign investors strolling by. He told me trade tensions at that time were a challenge.
Companies do not like risk, and we find ourselves in a time of a little bit of uncertainty, so it is a challenge.
3 months later, the challenge is even greater. I spoke with O'Neill today, and he told me three big projects involving Chinese investors in Arkansas are on hold. The Chinese conglomerate Sun Paper, for instance, says it'll have to pay an additional $150 million to import equipment for the cardboard factory it wants to build because of U.S. tariffs. O'Neill is trying to get an exemption for the equipment.
The discussions of the tariffs and the concerns there have certainly set the project back at least months.
This is not just happening in Arkansas. Projects all over the U.S. are on hold as foreign investors reassess.
These companies are pushing the pause button.
Nancy McLernan heads the Organization for International Investment, a trade group for multinational companies.
And a lot of that is most likely due to a very uncertain environment on trade policy.
And that environment isn't just bad for states. McLernan says more than 6 million Americans get a paycheck from a foreign employer. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You're there to please your specific client and to get their dreams made. And there's fallout along the way.
Hollywood and its difficult truths. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 0.2% today, 69 points, 26,492. The NASDAQ picked up 0.1%, 14 points there, ended things at 8,007. S&P 500 the other way, 0.1%, 3 points, finished at 29.15. Trade wars, oil prices, rising interest rates, pick your problem today. We'll pick oil prices to start. Crude, as I mentioned, topped $80 a barrel. That put the kibosh on some airline stocks. American descended nearly 3%. Delta down about 0.5%. Today, if on the other hand you're an oil company, Marathon bubbled up 0.6%. ConocoPhillips added about 1.3%. With the Fed expected to raise interest rates again tomorrow, financial stocks took a fall. JPMorgan Chase withdrew 0.2%. Goldman Sachs erased about the same. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose 3.09%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Every day, you make economic decisions that affect your life, including choices that aren't obviously about money. That's why Marketplace covers business and finance from so many different angles in a way that is smart, relatable, and even kind of fun. To keep public service journalism going strong, please go to Marketplace.org today and become a Marketplace investor with a donation in any amount. And we do appreciate your support. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We were talking yesterday about brands buying other brands as a way to make sure they can get at consumers across the economic spectrum. Today's version of that story comes to us from Fast Food. The private equity firm that owns Arby's and Buffalo Wild Wings is going to shell out $2.3 billion to buy this country's biggest drive-in restaurant chain, Sonic. Marketplace's Renata Sago has that one.
Sonic is like the fun, eccentric auntie of fast food chains. You can get a burger there, of course, but how about a 99-cent pretzel twist or a pickle slushy for $1.50? Those are the kind of varied offerings and prices that draw in 3 million customers a day. For Inspire brands, Sonic is an opportunity to bring a different type of restaurant to its portfolio, says Bert Flickinger with Strategic Resource Group.
Sonic has a great multiplier effect.
Sonic has 3,600 drive-in chains in 45 states. Flickinger says that could easily double in the next few years. That could be good news for Inspire brands if the economy slows, says R.G. Hadavi with Morningstar Research.
This is a quick service chain that probably works very well in a recessionary environment.
Inspire's higher-priced brands like Arby's may not be so recession-proof. Hadavi says growth in the fast food burger sector has been flat as chains compete for customers with each other and
non-traditional competitors such as convenience stores, grocery stores, meal kit services, they're being attacked on a number of fronts.
But Sonic offers some defense from that through its wide range of food options and digital services like mobile ordering. Adding Sonic may be a hedge against an economic downturn for Inspire, but Darren Seifer with the NPD Group says there could be a risk too. He says managing the operational needs of different brands could be challenging.
Sometimes if you're so diversified, it's hard to get efficiencies across your portfolio.
Inspire's deal to buy Sonic is expected to wrap up by the end of this year. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
I personally just want to know what a pickle slushy is. Also, why? All right, here's a business strategy question that is going to sound basic but isn't. As you think about your product line, do you go way high-end, expensive and tailored, or mass market, cheaper and broad-based? Such is the choice the drug maker Novartis made. The company is cutting more than 2,000 jobs, most of them in Europe, as it streamlines to focus on more innovative, read expensive to research and develop, and thus more expensive to consumers, drugs. Janet Babin has that one.
Novartis's overhaul will take the company away from cheaper generic drugs and further towards customized medicines, things like gene therapies and biologics. Damian Conover covers healthcare as an equity analyst at Morningstar.
This is an effort to focus on areas where there's higher return.
Novartis had some strong incentives to revise its business model. It lost a patent for a blockbuster cancer drug, Glivia, a few years ago. Wall Street analysts also slammed the company for not charging more for one of its popular leukemia drugs. Economics professor Frank Lichtenberg at Columbia Business School says these new medications won't be cheap, but they could be good for patients with rare diseases.
The medicines are also far better, that they are more effective in treating diseases.
Ezekiel Emanuel chairs the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He says there's a national problem with drug prices that needs to be tackled.
We need national drug price negotiation.
Because, Emanuel says, the current U.S. patent system gives drug companies effective monopolies and lets them charge higher prices for longer periods. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
So here's a couple of movies, big movies, as you'll hear, that might never have been made were it not for a guy named Michael Ovitz. Rain Man, Tootsie, Jurassic Park, also Schindler's List. Michael Ovitz grew up over the hills from Hollywood in the San Fernando Valley. Started working in the entertainment business, giving studio tours on Universal's back lot while he was still in high school, and eventually became one of the most powerful people in Hollywood. CAA, the talent agency that he founded and ran for 20 years, is still a force in town. His new memoir of his life and the business is called Who is Michael Ovitz? Michael Ovitz, thanks for coming into the studio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So the title of this book, Who is Michael Ovitz? And I'm going to paraphrase you, except in radio-friendly language. in a big part of this book, you come off as kind of a jerk.
Well, I was pretty honest about what occurred and what was some of the good things that we did, some of the bad things. When you're in a service business, you're in a place where you can't please everybody all the time. You're there to please your specific client and to get their dreams made. And there's fallout along the way.
And your role in that equation as the agent and the deal maker was what?
We were the facilitators, and we came up with this concept of putting creative people together. So if you personally had an idea, we would put you with other creative people to enhance it and then try to create something that gave all the creative people much more leverage against the buyer.
Which is the innovation and the disruption that CAA brought to this industry, right? You got a writer and an actor and a director and a producer. You packaged them and you got them to the studio. And you had the whole enchilada.
Well, the whole concept was to shift the balance of power from the buyer to the seller. And the clients needed that leverage, not just for financial reasons, but for creative reasons. You know, the biggest fights in the entertainment business are creative fights. Mm. A studio wants one ending. The director or actor or writer want another ending. We felt that the creative people were always right. And we felt that they needed to be backed, and we felt that they needed to have the support of an organization behind them, which they hadn't had for a long time.
Could you have been as successful as you were without the, and I think this is your word, obsessiveness, right? You were detail-oriented and mission-driven, which led to... As you say in the book, if your funeral was held today, 25,000 people would show up to make sure you were really dead. You know, could you have been Michael Ovitz without that drive?
I don't think so. In that time frame, in a really flush economy with the amount of options available, we had to set a stage that we were all knowing and had the ability to execute and could deliver almost anything, and we couldn't look weak. We couldn't look vulnerable. Could we have done it a little differently? Probably, with a little less of the aggressiveness. But I don't think we would have built the company in the period of time that we did without that push.
A word here about money. There's a lot of it in this book. You call it a scorecard for success. Does it have to be that way?
It doesn't have to be. Everybody has their own definition of what they want. There are a lot of people that do extraordinary things in life where money is a secondary issue. When you grew up the way I did, money became a scorecard. And when you want to, shall we say, get out of the valley, money is a pathway to be able to put you in a position to try to make the kind of social change or business change that you'd like to make. It equates with leverage, frankly.
As you look at Hollywood today, and the Me Too movement and some of the social changes that are happening. You're in a position of power in this industry for a really long time. Could you have done more in your time in power to make it a better place?
Well, it's really difficult to have these conversations today, looking back 30, 40 years. When we started the business in 74, these issues weren't brought to the surface like they are today. They weren't as apparent. We also didn't allow a lot of the things to occur. We didn't send clients into meetings unescorted. We had 40% of our staff were women. I think what's happening right now is good for the business. It's been a problem that's been an undercurrent in the business from day one. This is not a new issue. It never came to the surface.
Michael Ovitz. The book is called Who Is Michael Ovitz? Michael, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out today, in which, if you really think about it, Dunkin' Donuts finally comes clean. The company announced today it is rebranding as just Dunkin', no donuts. Said the press release, the new branding conveys the company's focus on serving great coffee fast. Also, that Dunkin' aims to, and again quoting, transform itself into the premier beverage-led on-the-go brand. I'll tell you what, try though I might, I will never understand branding. And we are out of here. Dow Industrials off 0.2% today, 69 points. NASDAQ picked up about 0.1%, 14 points. S&P 500, 0.1% the other way, 3 points to the downside. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.